Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan, who examines how U.S. and Israeli policies have strengthened hardliners in Iran while weakening that nation's embattled pro-democracy green movement. Nick Neihardt of the group Public Campaign, who assesses the effect of a recent Supreme Court ruling which cut off matching funds to candidates in Arizona participating in that state's public campaign finance system. And Gabriel Wisniewski of the environmental group Greenpeace, who discusses the Gulf oil disaster and the opportunity to reinvent the nation's broken energy infrastructure. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The news service ProPublica reports British Petroleum was warned repeatedly about their record of poor safety and environmental noncompliance in internal audits throughout the last decade. These warnings came in advance of several serious accidents in BP facilities in the U.S. BP's confidential reports showed the company ignored a rash of safety problems in Alaska, Texas, and California. According to these reports, BP management ignored warnings about aging infrastructure and pressured or harassed workers not to report safety problems and to cut short inspections to reduce production costs. An internal 2001 BP report on its Alaska operations noted the oil giant had neglected key equipment required for an emergency shutdown, including a safety cutoff valve and fire detectors. Similar equipment failed in the fire and explosion on the Deepwater Horizon rig in the Gulf of Mexico. In 2005, an emergency warning system failed before BP's Texas City oil refinery exploded into a ball of fire, after which an internal review found safety issues at all of BP's five refineries in the U.S. In 2009, the company was fined $87 million by OSHA for failing to upgrade safety compliance procedures at the Texas City plant. Former Environmental Protection Agency lawyer Jean Pascal, who investigated BP, asked, "At what point are we going to say we are not going to do business with BP anymore? None of the other supermajors have an environmental criminal record like they do." Upon his return to Peru, indigenous leader Alberto Pizango was arrested and soon released, only to face a criminal trial. His return from exile occurred nearly a year after a bloody conflict between police and protesters last June that left 34 people dead. Pizango, head of Peru's largest indigenous federation, AIDSTEP, faces charges of sedition, rebellion, and incitement to violence. The charges result from the bloody events in the northern city of Bagua, where activists resisted attempts by President Alan Garcia to open the Amazon to oil exploitation. Pizango returned to Lima, Peru, to proclaim his innocence. According to Amnesty International, the Federation leader was in Lima on June 5th last year, the day of the confrontation in Bagua. 24 police officers and 10 civilians died in the incident. It was Peru's deadliest civil conflict since its military launched an offensive against the Maoist Shining Path guerrillas in the late 1980s. Several weeks before the confrontation, Pizango called for Peru's government to annul a series of land laws passed without the informed consent of indigenous peoples. On his return to Lima, Pizango expressed his regret for the loss of life at the Bagua blockades and his wish for a spirit of reconciliation among all Peruvians. Latino residents of Arizona are starting to flee in anticipation of the state's tough new immigration law taking effect. According to USA Today, schools in Arizona's Latino neighborhoods are reporting sharp enrollment declines. Local ethnic businesses serving Hispanic residents are also struggling. The new immigration law, along with the impact of the severe recession since 2008, has hit the Latino population, both legal and undocumented, especially hard. Arizona's new immigration law requires police officers to ask about a person's immigrant status during routine traffic stops if there is any suspicion they may be in the U.S. illegally. In addition, the law makes it a state crime to be in the U.S. illegally or to disrupt traffic to hire day laborers, whether the worker's status is illegal or not. David Gutierrez, a professor at the University of California, San Diego, told the Christian Science Monitor, "The economy is always the primary factor in determining migration flows. It might appear that the law is turning back the demographic tide in Arizona, but economic factors are a much more important aspect. The population exodus comes as Arizona has also been hard hit by a growing tourism and convention boycott triggered by its new draconian immigration law. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
On the one-year anniversary of the June 12, 2009 Iranian presidential election, leaders of the country's opposition Green Movement were denied government permits and decided to cancel planned protests to mark the surge of popular dissent and the repression which followed the disputed election result. Fearing governmental reprisals, such as beatings, mass arrests, torture, and execution seen over the past 12 months, only small and scattered protests were organized around the country. Last year, hundreds of thousands of Iranians took to the streets to protest what they believed to have been a rigged election, robbing the leading opposition candidate, Mir Hossein Mousavi, of victory over incumbent President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. In assessing the weakened state of the Iranian opposition, University of Michigan history professor Juan Cole believes the policies of both the U.S. and Israel have strengthened hardliners in the Iranian regime, while undermining the Green Movement. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Professor Cole, who explains why he believes that President Obama's push for a fourth round of sanctions against Iran and the UN over its nuclear program, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's continued blockade of Gaza and his government's deadly attack against the Gaza aid flotilla, have put Iranian hardliners in a stronger position than they were 1 year ago.
The hardliners in Iran have brutally repressed this protest movement of the what's called the Green Movement. And one of the things that they do is to say, look, you know, we're not the problem here. The United States is trying to make it look like Tehran is the problem, like Iran is a bad actor, but we're not the problem. In fact, the real problem in the region, the hardliners say, is Israel. Israel has 200 nuclear warheads. It never signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and it is actively displacing the Palestinians from the West Bank and half-starving the ones in Gaza. This is the argument of the hardliners to the Iranian people. They will say, on the other hand, Iran has no nuclear weapons, doesn't want a nuclear weapon, isn't trying to get a nuclear weapon, even though it is constantly accused with no evidence of doing so by the West. And so Iran is being treated unfairly in comparison to Israel, completely unfairly, because the Israelis have done all the things that Iran is accused of doing in the nuclear arena, and yet the Israelis face no sanctions, and now the West is trying to put sanctions, economic sanctions, on Iran. So when we had in May a conference of the signatories of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and they invited Israel to join them and to begin working towards a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East, you know, it would have been a major propaganda victory or major coup politically against the hardliners in Iran if Israel had said, yes, we'll meet with you, we'll start discussing denuclearizing the region. And that would have, you know, leveled the playing field a little bit. Instead, the Israelis blew off the NPT signatories, and the United States backed them in that. So Iran can go on making this, the Iranian hardliners can go on making this argument not only to their own people, but then to the rest of the region. And that's only one area in which I think Western hypocrisy has helped the hardliners.
Professor Cole, what was the attitude, as best we know it, of the Iranian people on the topic of Iran's right to build nuclear weapons, or the other scenario that the Iranian government says that they're only pursuing nuclear power to produce electricity? Is that sort of a rallying cry of nationalism for the Iranian people? Is that something that draws people to the hardline government there?
Well, I think the nuclear enrichment program, which, as you say, the Iranians maintain, is not for weapons purposes, and there isn't, to be fair, any good evidence that they have a weapons program. But that nuclear enrichment program is seen as a symbol of Iranian nationalism. I think most Iranians in opinion polling support the nuclear enrichment program, assuming that it is for civilian purposes, for the purpose of producing fuel for nuclear reactors to make electricity. The last opinion poll that I saw suggested only about a fourth to a third Iranians would support going all the way for a bomb. And the regime itself, the supreme theocrat, the cleric Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who holds most of the reins of power in his grasp, denounces nuclear warheads as tools of the devil, as incompatible with the Islamic law of war, which forbids the killing of innocent men, women, and children.
If U.S. and Israeli policies had some negative blowback on the green movement in Iran, what should the Obama administration in particular do to help that movement gain strength after all this past years of repression? Some people might say the U.S. should have no fingerprints on any support for the green movement because it just adds fuel to the fire with hardliners who will say that they are puppets of the United States government.
Right. Well, it's a good question, and it's a very difficult situation because, as you say, I mean, one of the charges that the hardliners make against the green movement in Iran is precisely that it's, you know, a CIA-backed phony color revolution, and they maintain that there have been a number of these, and they consider Ukraine and Lebanon and so forth to be in those categories. So it probably does hurt the Greens to have the U.S. rally to their side very publicly and stridently, because then it gives ammunition to the hardliners to paint them as American puppets. On the other hand, I think that pressing for these increased sanctions, and there was talk of trying to prevent gasoline from getting into Iran, you know, that would hurt all Iranians. That's not the sort of thing the Green Movement wants. So I think that the sanctions hawks are acting in ways that harm the Green Movement. And I don't think that what people in Iran want to hear from the United States is they're going to be prevented from getting staples like gasoline. So I think that the best thing the U.S. can do for the Greens is to uphold American values in the Middle East, to combat the charge of hypocrisy. And so they should redouble their efforts to get a better deal for the Palestinians, to move to a two-state solution, to end the blockade of Gaza, which really is resulting in children being stunted from lack of nutrition. That's horrible. You know, that shouldn't be allowed. And if we do the right thing, if we act according to our own lights and our own constitutional values, I think it deprives the hardliners of a lot of talking points.
That was Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan. His latest book is titled Engaging the Muslim World. Visit his website, Informed Comment, Thoughts on the Middle East, History and Religion at juancole.com. Courts around the country seem to be invalidating public campaign finance laws as fast as they can be passed. The U.S. Supreme Court on June 8th issued an order reinstating a lower court injunction preventing the state of Arizona from providing matching funds to candidates for state office to stay on par with the spending of candidates who don't accept public financing, either because they are wealthy and can finance their own campaigns, or they accept large campaign donations from corporations or lobbyists. The court, which will not likely rule on the case until after this November's midterm election, issued the injunction stating that Arizona's public financing law puts an unconstitutional burden on the First Amendment rights of privately funded candidates. According to the group Public Campaign, which has been working to pass public finance laws at both the state and federal levels for the past 13 years, there are currently 7 states and 2 cities that have full public financing for some political offices. 3 states, Arizona, Connecticut, and Maine, provide full public financing for all statewide and legislative races. These laws were approved through a combination of ballot initiatives and state legislatures. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Nick Neihardt, co-founder, president, and CEO of Public Campaign. He explains how the Supreme Court's ruling on Arizona's public finance law could affect other states around the country, and how a different funding mechanism in the proposed Federal Fair Elections Now Act could pass constitutional muster.
This decision will likely have a national impact. There are a number of other states around the country that have campaign finance systems, clean election systems structured much like Arizona's. So the logic here is that the court would react the same way to a challenge on the similar provisions in the other states like Maine and Connecticut. Those three states have it for all legislative offices as well as statewide offices. But there are other states like North Carolina and New Mexico that have it for a number of statewide offices, including the judicial elections that they have in those states.
Connecticut's public financing law is in limbo right now, awaiting a federal court ruling after a lower court ruled last year that it was unconstitutional because of some specific provisions that discriminated against third parties. But it includes the same mechanism for leveling the playing field for candidates running against wealthy, self-funded opponents. And, you know, here in Connecticut, we happen to have a lot of millionaires from both parties running for governor and senator this year.
The whole point of these triggered matching funds was to allow other kinds of candidates to have speech, enough speech, so that they could run at a reasonable level and compete for office. So to make a public financing system work, you've got to be able to compete against the Lamonts and the Foleys and the McMahons and other wealthy candidates. So key to a public financing system working is to provide adequate funds. And that's what these triggered systems did. They said, we're not going to let the only people who can speak loudly in elections be candidates who are personally wealthy or who go to every lobbyist in town and shake them all down. And that's the terrible thing about what the court has done. It's actually, for a court that proclaims itself to be pro-free speech, this is an anti-speech move, unless, of course, you're a millionaire running for office.
How does the Supreme Court ruling relate to its much more publicized ruling in January that removed any restrictions on corporate funding of campaigns?
That January decision, which increased the already huge volume of big money, wealthy interest money in elections, one antidote to that is fair election system, as we call it, the federal level, or a clean election system, as it has been called in a number of states. This decision makes the metrics a little bit different. You have to find another way to provide lots of money for a candidate who may not have personal assets to run. And fortunately, there's a way to do that. In the federal fair elections bill, I think 153 co-sponsors right now in the House, 20 in the Senate, that has this small donor-based kind of matching funds. At the state level, where the laws are already in place and working, they have the triggered matching funds that depend on your opponent spending additional money for you, the publicly financed candidate, to get additional money. Those laws at the state level will have to be changed.
You know, Nick Neihardt, unlike the January decision, this ruling seems to have generated very little media coverage. And I guess you could say maybe that's because these provisions are in place in so few states. But it just seems like another bold attack on the effort to level the playing field and have truly democratic elections. Do you think the public cares?
I think voters in general are outraged about the attitude of the Supreme Court as regards big money. This is a court that, in its own terms, is pro-free speech for those with lots of money, but hasn't been helping the speech of ordinary citizens. And I think that's the reason that people don't like the Supreme Court, which has essentially been an ally, not of the Constitution, but of the big money forces that now dominate American politics. And the public is outraged about that. I don't think the public follows the details of each decision, but I certainly think there's a public view that this is a Supreme Court not on the we the people side, but on the side of the most powerful interests in our political structure, and that is the corporations that can spend huge amounts of money influencing campaigns. When you look at the oil industry and its giving, how it allowed, political system allowed a company like BP to do deep drilling without sufficient safeguards in place and with very, very limited liability, $75 million, that was all the doings of a U.S. Congress and previous administrations that worked hand in glove with the oil industry instead of regulating it for the ordinary consumer's, ordinary taxpayer's sake. So I think at the federal level, the kinds of problems that we see on the front pages of the news every day are also big money and politics problems. So there has been a galvanizing, really, since the Supreme Court decision, of new efforts to blunt the impact of corporate money. And one of the biggest ones of those is the Fair Elections Now Act, which is steadily gaining support in the House and could win a House vote this year and be sent on to the Senate.
That was Nick Neihardt of Public Campaign. Contact the campaign by calling area code 202-293-0222 or visit their website at publiccampaign.org. On the eve of President Obama's first address to the nation from the Oval Office on the continuing Gulf of Mexico oil spill, estimates for how much oil is gushing into the water from British Petroleum's blown-out well now range from 35,000 to 60,000 barrels a day, more than 7 to 12 times earlier estimates of 5,000 barrels daily. Representative Edward J. Markey, Democrat of Massachusetts, contended that BP's lowballing of the amount of oil flowing into the Gulf was either deliberate deception or gross incompetence. Responding to criticism of his handling of the worst environmental disaster in U.S. history, President Obama has toured the Gulf Coast several times over recent weeks and named Michael Bromwich, a former Justice Department official, to clean up the government's Minerals Management Service, the agency that's under fire for its lax supervision of the nation's offshore oil drilling. But many environmental groups assert that it will take more than reorganizing government agencies to prevent future deadly oil spill disasters and coal mining accidents, but rather requires a national commitment to building a sustainable energy future. In a new report from Greenpeace and the European Renewable Energy Council titled Energy Revolution, A Sustainable USA Energy Outlook, the groups provide a comprehensive blueprint that they say will reduce carbon emissions while achieving economic growth by replacing fossil fuels with renewable energy and energy efficiency. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Gabriel Wisniewski, Greenpeace climate campaigner, who discusses the Gulf oil disaster and the opportunity to reinvent the nation's broken energy infrastructure.
You know, we have to look at this from a couple of different angles, and obviously the first one is, what is our direct response to the disaster that's happened and is still happening, and how can we protect the ecosystem and the communities along the Gulf the most and the quickest? But then we also, I think, need to back up and realize that, you know, this time it was BP. But really, the Minerals Management Service, which is a part of the Department of Interior, as you mentioned, has a very close relationship with the oil industry, and has for a long time. And it's that lax oversight that, in part, led to the disaster that we're seeing in the Gulf. But frankly, this sort of disaster is what we can expect if we continue to rely on fossil fuels like oil and coal indefinitely. Frankly, there's no way to do these things safely, and there's no way to do these things cleanly. So the only way to avoid accidents like this permanently is to quickly get ourselves off of oil and quickly get ourselves off of coal and embrace renewable energy like wind and solar that doesn't carry these sorts of risks.
Gabriel, describe for our listeners the importance of the Greenpeace report, Energy Revolution Evolution, A Sustainable USA Energy Outlook. What does that document tell us?
The Energy Revolution is a report that Greenpeace released with the European Renewable Energy Council. It's both a global report, and then there's a close look at the United States' role in it. And basically, it begins with the premise that we need to do what scientists tell us is required to prevent runaway climate change, with the understanding that if climate change goes unchecked, as it will if we don't act really boldly, the impacts will be hard to imagine. Economically, we're talking about major percentages of global GDP being spent on the adaptation and sort of late-stage mitigation of climate change, and then the human and environmental costs of climate change just massive in terms of floods and droughts and food shortages and water shortages, rising seas. It really boggles the imagination to think of what could happen if we don't do anything. So this report starts with the assumption that we need to do to follow the science on climate change. And it looks at what technologies exist and what policies exist and have been tested in the real world to promote renewable energy. And it basically lays out a path, a roadmap, talking about how you can phase out fossil fuels like coal and oil and quickly ramp up both renewable energy like wind and solar and geothermal, but also how to squeeze every last drop out of the energy you're producing. We waste so much energy in this country and in the world that if we, you know, if we closed the window, so to speak, we could account for a lot of the projected growth in our energy demand. So it's a basically a blueprint for how do we get from where we are now, dependent on fossil fuels, cleaning up an oily mess in the Gulf and mourning coal miners, and here and looking at a future of unchecked climate change, how do we get from there to renewable, sustainable energy economy?
Gabriel, very often, particularly in news coverage of this British Petroleum oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, you hear pundits talking about the necessity to keep on drilling because this country is addicted to oil, and there's really no new technology or no new approach by government or industry that's going to replace oil in the near or long-term future. And that is the message that goes out to the American people over and over again, that there really is no hope to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels anytime soon. What message does this report from Greenpeace give us that contradicts that kind of doom and gloom scenario that we're going to be with oil and oil's going to be with us for a long, long time to come?
Yeah, that, you know, you just put your finger on it. That's a very, frankly, a very expensive lie that's put out there by the industry, and unfortunately is just sort of taken at face value and parroted by a lot of politicians and by a lot of people in the media that we can't, that we have to have fossil fuels, and that we simply have to deal with the sorts of things that we're dealing with now in the Gulf. And this report really pushes back on that lie and calls out the idea that, you know, if you take the bold steps in the short term to invest money in renewables and in efficiency, not only can you get off fossil fuels, but you can create a lot of jobs and save a lot of money in the meantime.
That was Gabriel Wisniewski, Greenpeace climate campaigner. Contact Greenpeace USA at 1-800-326-0959. Or visit their website at greenpeace.org, where you can download a copy of the group's Energy Revolution Plan. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446. Or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.